Fantasy Blueprint with Matt Williamson and Ryan McDowell.
Welcome to another edition of the Dynasty Blueprint. I'm your host, Ryan McDowell, joined today by Matt Williamson. Matt, crazy day in the NFL today. What do you think of some of these moves?
Yeah, man, we could talk about it a little bit more, but, I mean, Josh Norman, and they're dumping the franchise tag on him. That's a really odd timing for that, and I do want to touch on that a little bit here after we introduce our great guest. And another monster trade, you know, I mean, just when we thought it was going to be Tennessee and Cleveland picking at the top of the draft, that's not the case anymore, man. Big things are happening.
Yeah, the draft is still over a week away, but we're having a lot of NFL action even in these upcoming days. So that makes it fun. We do have a great guest with us today. We've got Matt Waldman. Of course, Matt does some work for Football Guys, and he's probably most well known, especially this time of year, for his rookie scouting portfolio. Matt, how are you, man?
I'm doing great. It's like a hyperactive two Dynasty League reunion we've got going on here.
That's right.
I'm a newcomer to that league.
That's right.
If only MFL was up, we could maybe pull off a trade during the episode, but we'll have to wait a couple days for that, maybe.
Absolutely.
Well, let's jump into this trade. Matt, I know you mentioned it, and I know you have some thoughts on it. So the deal is the Eagles make the big move. They've already moved up from the middle of the first round. They made the deal to get up to the eighth pick, and now they move again to the second overall pick. They get the second, they get a fourth next year, and they gave up a lot. The Browns move down, they get the eighth overall pick. They also get 77 and 100 in this year's draft. They get a 2017 first and a 2018 second. So the conventional wisdom says they're going to take Carson Wentz. Williamson, let's start with you. What do you think about this deal for the Eagles?
Well, I actually just put an article out about it that I feel like they had such a good offseason, it allowed them to do this. You know, that whenever I was writing team need pieces going into the draft, the Eagles were one of the teams I had the hardest time coming up with needs for. Yeah, I think they need a running back. Sure, there's some things they could use, but I think they really were extremely proactive even before free agency started. I mean, there's going to be a new offense, a new defense, and they kept guys like Curry and Graham and Ertz and Bradford and, you know, on both sides of the ball, and they were very aggressive in free agency to fill their holes. And I think that they were setting themselves up for this draft to basically take best guy available without reaching for need. So this is one of the few chances, I think, in this franchise's, you know, near future that they can actually make a move like this. You know, it's one draft that they could sort of, you know, miss out a little bit, and maybe they're able to trade Sam Bradford. I mean, who knows? That could be the next shoe to drop, but I mean, I know he's expensive, and recoup some of those picks. I like it, and, you know, from the Browns' perspective, you know, we don't know a lot about this front office for Cleveland, but it's pretty clear they value draft picks above everything else. You know, they're letting free agents go left and right to pick up comp picks for next year. And, you know, I'm sure there's some Browns fans out there going, well, we really want to Goff or Wentz. Well, let me break this to you. You're going to be the worst team in the league next year, and you're going to have your choice of any quarterback you want in 2017.
So there's a lot of ways to go with that. Let's start with Carson Wentz, who it does appear he's going to be the pick there at number two. Matt, I know in your RSP you've got Wentz as your quarterback three. What do you think, if this does play out like we think it will, what do you think about the fit of Wentz in Philadelphia?
I think one thing that is worthwhile to consider here is if they don't trade Bradford and they stay true to what they're saying on the surface, which I think we all realize is probably not as likely, but even if they do decide that they're going to stick with Bradford for the season, they're going to give Wentz a developmental timetable, but I think everybody in the media and everyone who has been following the NFL for a while knows that GMs like to say that they're not going to start the guy right away, and then halfway through the season, the guy's on the field. But if they do stay true to this and they decide, look, we're going to have a chance to reset a little bit, as Matt has been referring to, you know, kind of mentioned there, You have a guy that maybe they can give a little bit of a developmental plan to give him some time on the field from the second half of the season moving onward and give him a chance to actually just make a nice transition to the league without having to be thrown in right away. And if that happens, I think that he can be a good fit. When you look at what the Eagles offer in terms of wide receiver talent, tight end talent, and what it has with its running game right now, I think Wentz right away is a decent fit because the strength of his game is really passing between, you know, the line of scrimmage and about 15 to 25 yards. You get him inside that range, and he can be pinpoint accurate when it comes to his first reads. Sometimes with his second reads, he's a very good play-action quarterback. He's skilled at being able to move around so you can get him outside the pocket and give him, you know, one side of the field to make decisions with. And I think that in that standpoint, guys like Jordan Matthews, Nelson Agholor, you know, these are guys that aren't really great. You know, maybe Agholor can become a good deep threat, but you don't have anybody who's really a proven take the top off the defense player, you know, at that position right away. And I know that John Gruden likes Carson Wentz's deep ball accuracy, but I didn't see it. I thought it was he had general accuracy, which to me is if you have a guy who can rebound the ball deep. And kind of as Kian Fahey has said, kind of erase some of the small inaccuracies that happen with deep passing that isn't pinpoint. Then you've got something there. But I don't think he's pinpoint right now, and I think it's going to take him a little bit of time. And also first reads, you know, actually making easy reads. I don't think he makes a lot of good easy reads. So when I look at him, he needs some time. The talent's there physically. I think that initially there's some things with what the Eagles have for him to be a decent fit. But I do also like this trade from the standpoint that it seems like the Eagles are trying to say, okay, this is what we're about. We're going to reestablish the identity that we had in the past. Let's do a 4-3 defense. We drafted a guy like Brandon Graham, who was supposed to be a really fine pass rusher at DE, and he ended up being in, you know, purgatory as an outside linebacker. So when you look at what they're trying to do, I think they're trying to go backwards a little bit to what their days were, maybe, you know, in terms of taking what some of their existing talent is and trying to fit them in the best possible way, especially on defense, and then pick a guy like Wentz who that maybe they can give a little bit of time to that they feel like has high upside.
Matt, just to kind of piggyback on that, though, and I think we have to realize, too, that this is going to be the East Coast version of the Chiefs, I think. You know, I mean, Reed took it from the Eagles to the Chiefs and back. They're going to be run first. Their offseason moves was Newski and Brandon Brooks. I mean, they built up that line immediately. They didn't let Lane Johnson get away. I assume they'll bring a running back in. So you know, I'm not saying Wentz is going to be Alex Smith, but I don't think they're going to ask a lot of him. You know, and what you were just saying as a scouting report of him, I think that makes, you know, that kind of goes hand in hand pretty well. Not to mention you have Daniel there as your backup quarterback. If you do happen to trade Bradford or Joe Flacco or Andy Dalton or somebody gets hurt in week one and then they come calling and you trade Bradford and then Daniel just kind of holds the ship in place until Wentz is there.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute way of looking at this. I mean, it's kind of like Peterson holding the fort for Donovan McNabb way back in the day. Now you have Daniel being the same type of guy for Wentz. And Wentz, to me, isn't that guy who is going to create a ton for you right away right now, and it's more from a conceptual standpoint pre-post-snap right now. But if you ask him to say, you know, if you ask him to do certain things, I like the fact that he can drop back on that first read and hit it pinpoint within, you know, 15 to 20 yards with a go-to receiver and make some of those plays. But I do feel like that, you know, it is a situation where let's keep it simple. Let's try and run. Let's try and be a, you know, run, play strong defense. And we can develop a guy over time where he doesn't have to be the captain of the ship in the way that a lot of these teams' offenses demand.
And it does sound, and this is always through media, and I know this isn't what you do in the RSP either, but it sounds like he is an absolute student of the game and lives and breathes football, and he's, you know, he's not a dummy. I mean, he's going to learn rather quickly, and, oh, he's from North Dakota State. That doesn't, you know, matter to me one bit.
No, not at all. I mean, I definitely agree with that. He's definitely a smart player. It's just a matter of, again, just kind of getting a acclimated to the speed of the game. That's going to be the jump from college football to the NFL. Doesn't matter what program he's been with from that standpoint. And again, just kind of refining the things that he's continuing to have to work with. He's a, You know, some of the things that he has to work with are just things that you see a lot with quarterbacks who are making that jump. Footwork, being able to be a little bit quicker with your reads and getting your feet and your eyes in sync, and so that that way that when you're making a move from progression to progression, that your feet aren't lagging behind and you're having mechanical errors because of the fact that your brain's operating a little bit slow, or your feet's operating a little slower than your brain is at this point. So he just has to get a little sharper, and that's just something that takes time and relentless work that you expect from a top, you know, a top pick at quarterback, and he's going to get that opportunity to do it, because if there is a position in the NFL where you have a support staff that's actually going to work with you on your skills in addition to the X's and O's, it's going to be the quarterback position.
Let's dig into this a little bit more just from a dynasty perspective. And I think this may be an obvious question, but so we were thinking Wentz is going to Cleveland. Now it looks like he's going to Philadelphia. Do we like him more in Philadelphia than we would have in Cleveland?
Oh, come on, man. That's an easy one. Cleveland's a nightmare.
Yeah, I would agree with that. They absolutely are. I mean, I you know, my cousin who lives in Cleveland, and I grew up in Cleveland, you know, I joked with him about the trade today, and he said, you know, Robert Griffin's probably going to be, you know, and he's a typical fan, and it's just more of, you know, Robert Griffin's going to be out of the league within a year and probably in a wheelchair at the rate that, you know, the way things are going, which hopefully, God forbid, not. But, you know, it's the type of thing that you look at the situation, and they have a lot of holes to fill. And this is a team that has traded down and gotten extra picks and has not been able to use those picks wisely to pick talent that has, that's going to help their team. And Griffin is a guy who was obviously, you know, top prospect. I thought that he had a chance to develop into a pocket quarterback if he wasn't in the Shanahan system. I think that, you know, what happened to him in the past few years, he's starting from ground zero at this stage, and maybe even from a negative standpoint because of what went on, you know, whether you believe, you know, whether you look at him being immature and looking at that, that was a big part of the blame, or whether that Mike Shanahan is more of a manipulative type of individual and whether that was more to blame. Either way, they both have a share in it, and then on top of it, he's dealt with injuries that are going to, you know, be big question marks about whether or not he's going to be able to move the way he once did. And the answer is likely not. So that means he's starting from ground zero as a pocket player. So, yeah, it's much better that Carson Wentz ended up in Philadelphia at this stage. There's, you know, there's a younger, better line that's in place. And I think that for, you know, I think that for Cleveland right now, you know, getting a quarterback this early and throwing him to the Wolves would be a really bad idea.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to expand upon that. Whenever they made this deal and the rumor came about, I immediately thought of David Carr. Like, hey, maybe we need to build something first before we throw this poor guy in there. But, you know, with no running game, no receivers, who knows if Josh Gordon's coming back. The line is, you know, two-fifths lesser than it was before. Defense isn't going to do us any favors. And we're going to be terrible next year, so we'll get our quarterback at that point. So I kind of understand this logic, and it's real easy just to throw the Browns under the bus because they've historically been the worst franchise in recent memory, and, I mean, I was there. But it's a new group. I mean, these are new decision makers, and I think they have a plan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. And I'm actually a little more hopeful myself because of the fact that they are going to be – it's a different group of people doing the shopping this year. So I'm hoping that there's going to be some level of continuity with them and Hugh Jackson. And hopefully there's not – hopefully the owner doesn't make any decisions that override – what the staff does, and maybe the, you know, maybe the owner at this point is a little bit more confident or chastened by what had happened in the past, and maybe, you know, the conversations that he's had with their current, you know, personnel people, that he's going to stay out of the way a little bit. And if that happens, I think that, yeah, they can build for the future with this many picks. And maybe the hope too is that, you know, from what I remember, McCown's still there, so maybe they go with McCown a little bit early and give Griffin a year to be that redshirt player. And if they do that, then that would be, I don't know if it's going to be any better, but it would be encouraging to me as someone who likes to see quarterbacks sit a little bit longer than what we see.
Yeah, and you know, if you brought in a first-round pick, how much attention could Hugh Jackson and the quarterback coach with limited practice time give RG3 and the new guy? You know what I mean? Like, maybe you just, your little pet project this year is, let's see if we can resurrect RG3's career. And I don't think any of us are fans of him, but I also think there's more than a 1% chance that he can get back to being a talented individual, possibly, and Hugh Jackson might be the guy for that.
Yeah, I think so. I like reclamation projects. I probably have a soft spot for that. So I would like, you know, obviously I would like to see a guy like Griffin get a chance to prove that he can be what he wanted to be, which was more of a pocket passer. And the one thing that he's going to have to learn, at least going back to his Baylor days, where it was before we got clouded with what happened in Washington, is that while he'd stand in the pocket tough, he also kind of had that Michael Vick syndrome when it came to taking some hellacious hits, you know, at the last second and stand in there. And you got to show a little bit better ability to climb and move. And I saw some of that at Baylor, but not enough of it to not be a little alarmed by the punishment that he took in that way. So, you know, another year that could help out. I mean, we've certainly seen in the past guys who have moved around. Now it's probably more in the age range of Matt and myself in terms of guys that we're looking back on who are more exceptions to the rule, you know, who have been able to sit for a while and then, you know, develop into the promising quarterbacks that people thought they'd be. But I do like the option there to be able to sit and wait and just build in a more patient way and, you know, kind of take, I guess one way is looking at it is kind of that approach that Seattle took, which is, you know, building everything around, building everything up, and then getting a quarterback at some point. And either that's through free agency, through a trade, or if they find the right guy in the draft.
Well, the big draft pick trade was not the only news of the day. We also had a surprise move. The Carolina Panthers rescind the franchise tag for Josh Norman. He's now an unrestricted free agent. And according to reports, the Panthers have no interest in even talking contract with him. They're ready to move on from him. So you have to assume they're looking for a DB pretty early in the draft. Williamson, thoughts on that surprise move?
It's surprising because of the timing, really. I mean, it's not like, boy, we're going to use this money somewhere else all of a sudden. There's nowhere really to spend it if you're the Panthers. And you kind of, I don't want to say you screw the player over, because there are enough landing spots now that with some teams that have money, they just aren't good teams. I mean, it's San Francisco, it's Tennessee. You know, some of those type of teams I think will be in the market for them. But when you look at Josh Norman, there's two things I want to mention here is, he's not Darrelle Revis. He's not Deion Sanders. I mean, he's a zone corner that probably had the best year of his career that he'll ever have. And he had a great front seven. And the Panthers know what they're doing. I mean, more and more, they jump off the page to me as one of the most intelligent organizations out there. And it's very clear how they prioritize their defense. I mean, their front seven is littered with first-round picks and big-money guys. And including Josh Norman, their entire secondary are all fourth-round picks, fifth-round picks, retread, you know, Roman Harper-type guys that cost nothing. They just happen to hit on Norman. And the reason they do that is because they play a ton of zone, and they don't ask a lot out of their defensive backs. So you didn't want him to leave in the beginning. That's why they franchised him. But I think their team philosophy is, we don't want a big chunk of our pie tied up in defensive backs. And there's a lot of teams. There's a couple other teams that do that. I mean, I'm here in Pittsburgh. That's what the Steelers do. In a way, that's what Seattle does. They just happen to hit on Richard Sherman. And Earl Thomas is the exception there. But even Cam Chancellor is a fourth-round pick. So if you're going to play a lot of zone, it makes some sense that that's where you cut corners.
All right. Well, what we're here to discuss tonight is Matt's rookie scouting portfolio. Again, it's just a godsend to dynasty players this time of year. I've been continuously reading over it. I just leave that window open on my computer and check it out a little bit at a time each day and each night. Just amazing work. And as you look over the hundreds and hundreds of pages, you know, it's obvious how much work you put into that each year. So just goes without saying, but thank you for your work with that. And it's just a treat to dynasty players.
Wow. Well, thank you. I mean, it's definitely nice to be able to have, you know, folks who enjoy reading it, and I love doing the work, and it's nice to have the encouragement of folks like you guys and to be able to, you know, talk. I look forward to getting to talk about players, talk about the draft at this time of the year after doing the work. So that, you know, thank you for having me on.
Matt, and I would echo that. I mean, the RSP is unbelievable, and I've heard you on – you've obviously done the podcast tour, too. I've heard you on a lot of different podcasts out there, and it's great to have you on ours. But the one thing I wanted you to bring up is and it can get overlooked, but a portion of your proceeds go to an unbelievable cause, too. Can you kind of tell everybody about that?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. Thanks for mentioning that. The organization that I donate 10% of each sale to is called Darkness to Light. And Darkness to Light is an organization that's designed to provide training to help prevent sexual abuse in communities, as well as to address sexual abuse in an appropriate manner, so that it doesn't get out of hand. Because one of the biggest one of the most dangerous things about this type of abuse is how the community can react to it without a good level of education. And we saw that happen at Penn State, which is unfortunate because it's such a great institution. What we saw kind of went down there with the Sandusky, with what happened with Jerry Sandusky and these kids. So, you know, one of the things that I decided to do was around 2012 was to thought that as football fans, I thought it would be a good idea for to be able to show kind of a stance of saying that this is something that obviously we're against this type of thing happening. We want to do the right thing. We want to be, out in front of this type of an issue. And so this organization has one of the only training methodologies that has been studied from an academic scientific standpoint that's proven that works, and they train civic organizations, corporations, police, school teachers, individuals, you name it, on pretty much the things to spot and to understand about the dynamics of sexual abuse, as well as how to create environments that prevent that type of dynamic from happening. So it's a great organization. I've been giving to them for a while, and it's just been fantastic to be able to link up with them in this fashion.
That's great information. I of course knew that a part of your proceeds went to that charity, but didn't know all of that. So that's great to hear, and obviously a generous thing for you, and makes it an even easier decision for Dynasty players and football fans of all sorts to purchase that and help that organization as well.
Along those lines, and just before we get into players, I just wanted to ask you, Matt, I mean, anyone who's picked up the RSP or is even slightly familiar with it, you show all your work. I mean, there's a countless hours in that document, clearly. And I know a big portion of what you do and your process was derived from the job you had, I think, at the University of Georgia. So do you still have a real job?
That's a good question. My last gig was actually before the University of Georgia gig, and that's where I got it from, and it was more from being a director back there. I'm a magazine writer at the University of Georgia at their business school. I do features writing for their magazine. It goes out to about 100,000 alumni, and I help edit. I'm the associate editor of that magazine. But there's a possibility, it won't be long probably that gig will probably be I will probably be just doing the RSP and writing about football. That's probably closer to my end point than further away.
Let's dig into some of these individual players, and one thing I respect about your work, Matt, is that you don't just have these cookie cutter rankings or evaluations of players, and it's so easy this time of year to get into the echo chamber where everybody basically has the same rankings, the same evaluation of players, both from an NFL draft perspective and when it comes to dynasty or fantasy football. So I want to look at some players that I consider outliers when looking at your work, players that you have either higher or lower than you could say the consensus might rank them. So let's just start at quarterback. You've got Cardale Jones as your quarterback too. Just share some of what you saw from him that made you a fan of his.
Sure, and I would like to start and just say that I think the reason why my stuff isn't always cookie cutter is, one, as Matt alluded to, I don't really have time to look at anything else with the amount of work I'm doing right now. So I'm kind of in my own space a lot for many for many months out of the year. And then on top of that, because I'm so process-driven with what I do, and it was based on the fact that I was trying to show people, look, I wasn't a scout like Matt Williamson. I wasn't a former player. I didn't have that kind of cred. So in order for me to develop some level of credibility, I had to show people all my math. And so this process helped me do that and also helped me refine the process that I was doing. So with that in mind, as I, you know, and I'm a student of the game. That's really how it works, because a lot of times I'm going to get these things wrong. But if I don't get them wrong doing them my way, then I'm never going to make the process better, because I can't get in Matt Williamson's mind and figure out where he's coming from when he has a take that turns out to be right, but I take his word for it, but I don't get a chance to really develop it through my own process. So it's something, you know, that's kind of where that goes. So Cardale Jones, what I like about him, and I'm looking at it purely from talent at this standpoint and not from the standpoint of risk management or anything like that, I look at Cardale Jones and I love the fact that what he did last 2 years ago at the end of the season, I saw a player who didn't have many reps throughout his career, who didn't have the opportunity to develop rapport with his teammates, and he still exhibited a lot of skill in terms of decision making. And I know that he had some flawed decisions, certainly decisions that could have cost them the national championship during aspects of the game, at least in Oregon, and then some of the mistakes that he made along the way before then. But I felt like I could see through some of that decision making that if he had a little, you know, maybe if he, there were times that maybe he was a little hesitant with letting the ball go when you could see that he saw the open man, but he was a little late on deciding to pull the trigger, and he decided to just keep the ball and run with it rather than try to force the ball in there. You know, some people may nitpick that and say, well, he's not a decisive guy. I saw that as more of, he hasn't played with these receivers for 2.5 years. He hasn't played with any. He hasn't played on the field, and he's a little bit tentative in ways that I don't think he will be once he gets more playing time. I felt like that he showed some good reads in the middle of the field, some accuracy there, the willingness to stand in the pocket and make big throws downfield and take hits. I like the mobility and the strength there, even though I want to see a guy who's also going to learn to protect himself. And I just thought that looking at the set of all those skills and how he did put them together in really the biggest games any player in college football can ever have, I thought he did a fantastic job with that. And the things that he didn't do well, I thought were more from a reason of that he was never really a great fit in Columbus. He was a Jim Tressel recruit. He comes in at the same time Urban Meyer comes in. I don't want to call Urban Meyer's offense the Tim Tebow offense, but I'd be painting that with a broad stroke. But you can understand what I'm saying, that the quarterback there is going to be more of a read option heavy player. And Cardale Jones, to me, was a little bit more of a drop back guy who didn't fit perfectly in that scheme. And what he showed to me is someone that can be a good drop back player. He's just going to need some time. And to me, I mean, if the Browns could get him, you know, much further down the line, you know, fourth, fifth round, maybe if they could get him that late and let him sit for a little bit, and then build up this team, that might not be a bad way to go. I mean, I think that he's that kind of talent. If you let him sit for a little bit and get adjusted to the scheme and then give him some playing time here and there, he will, I think the decisions he made on the big stage, the way that he handled the speed of the game after not playing college football really at all, what just tells you the kind of talent that he has as both a decision maker and an executor in terms of physical and technical skill.
In terms of Jones, I want to see him in Arizona. I want to see him in Pittsburgh, you know, I mean, with a coach that's going to let him be aggressive. Yes. 3 years from now, you know, or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be perfect. I mean, they're the two best landing spots I can come up with. And he's not Logan Thomas, you know, I mean, and I think you made a great point, too, that he really doesn't fit the system, and I think the casual fan remembers him during that stretch on national TV, and yeah, he made a couple runs, and he's not a stiff, but also because of the color of his skin, I think people just assume, oh, he's a runner. You know, that's not what he is. I mean, I think he's a pocket passer, downfield, you know, big arm guy.
Yeah, and I think that the best way that I've tried to argue it, because I know Jason Wood of Football Guys and I had a really nice debate about it the other night, because he just thought I was crazy for ranking Cardale there. But you know, I said to him about this offense, it's like, what if, I know this is a kind of a stretch, but what if Matt Ryan came to Ohio State and played in and was relegated to third string in Urban Meyer's offense because he's not a mobile enough guy compared to, you know, players who would compare well to JT Barrett or Braxton Miller? Would he necessarily, you know, if he didn't decide to, like, transfer and decide to stick it out, and then you see him play and show some of these skills from the pocket, I'm not comparing Cardale to Matt Ryan in terms of the level of talent and refinement that he's at, but it, to me, it's the dynamic of you take a good pocket passing prospect and you put him in the wrong system, and he can get buried there. There's a lot of talent in the college game that can get buried because of those types of dynamics of coaching changes. And what's he going to do? You know, I mean, it's like, it's not every day that a player's going to say, in my last year, I'm going to switch to another school, and then everybody's now going to question the level of talent that I faced and whether or not, again, you're dealing with, you know, changes in system and rapport. I mean, a guy like Vernon Adams, for instance, to make the switch that he did, it takes a lot of stones to do that and then play well. But he had nowhere to go but up. He was moving up to Oregon as opposed to moving somewhere else in terms of profile of schools.
That's an awesome point. And, like, when I was at Pitt, we recruited Joe Flacco, but Tyler Palko was there, who is older. He's a local legend here in Pittsburgh. Joe transferred. I mean, there's a lot of transferring at the college level, and then there's some that just don't because you lose a year or whatever, and I don't even know the rules at this point, to be very honest. But that also brings me to the next point, and you brought up Vernon Adams, and there's been a couple transfers from Florida. I look at this draft class from the quarterback position and think, okay, you know, I mentioned the Steelers or the Giants or one of these teams that don't need a quarterback. The mid-rounds for this quarterback class might be a lot better than it's been the last few years, and I expect there to be a lot more quarterbacks drafted than there's been the last couple classes.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, and I'm glad you feel that way as well, because I know that Mark Schofield at Inside the Pylon and I have talked throughout the months on occasion saying that, you know, we've joked that if the league would be a little more patient with quarterbacks, this mid-round quarterback class could be a really nice group of finds there. And there are a lot of guys, including Adams, who is, you know, if they can get over the height issue and what his build is like, I think that what he does as a distributor of the football, it is really impressive to look at. I like Mike Bercovici. That's a guy that I like at Arizona State with his arm strength. And he was also another guy miscast in his system. Kevin Hogan is a guy that his mechanics are awful when it comes to how he throws the football and how he uses his feet. But from what I'm told, Will Hewlett, who is a quarterback consultant with a number of teams who's been on the RSP film rooms, he said to me that what he knows and hears is that Hogan's mind for the game is off the charts. So if he can fix the mechanical stuff just enough that it's not completely inefficient or going to hurt his game, that he could be a find. And then even guys like Rudock, you know, Jake Rudock, who, you know, I know some guys who are like, eh, whatever, he wasn't all that great at Iowa. But some of the things that I saw and what Harbaugh was able to get out of him, I think this guy could be a nice backup in the league. You know, I mean, there's certainly some nice skills there in terms of what he does playing in an offense where he can drop from center, make some reads, make the right decision, use the play-action game, and he showed enough of an arm, I thought, that, yeah, he could be a competent player in this league, and if he can get a little bit stronger. And that's just, you know, I just mentioned three or four guys, and we're not even talking about guys like Dak Prescott who are, you know, or Lynch or anybody who's a higher-profile, big-name quarterback who isn't in the first round. Connor Cook, another perfect example of a guy with excellent accuracy, you know, inside 25 yards.
And I know Driscoll and Brissett, I mean, they have traits, yeah. You know. And the one guy you didn't mention, though, is Christian Hackenberg.
Yeah. I didn't mention Christian Hackenberg. And you know it's funny because I've been waiting to watch the Gruden QB camp on him, because I always love watching Gruden on these shows, because whatever you want to say about, you know, if you're the most hardened cynic, you might say, look, it's a PR game here. For one hand, it's part entertainment. Part of it, too, is that you wonder how much an agent or a player has say in terms of what is going to be shown and what's not going to be shown on these episodes. But it's, you know, there's something there's some educational aspects about it. There's an interview. It's the closest thing to a team visit that we're going to get to see as the general public. You know, so I like to watch these shows, and Hackenberg is my 18th rated guy, which is probably lower than anybody out there. And the biggest reasons are is that one, I do recognize physically he's a first round prospect. You know, he's got the arm. He certainly has the prototypical size you're looking for. Came from a storied program, and I can understand why people are looking at him to take that risk. But the things that bother me are, part of them are issues of inconsistency, and part of them are things that I wonder if he's ever going to get better at. And watching the Gruden episode this morning, it made me think about writing an article to revisit Hackenberg a little bit, because if some of the issues that Gruden outlined, which were protection calls, how he handled protection calls, and being able to, you know, and the fact that it sounded like, and he looked kind of uncomfortable having to say, the coaches asked me to change my footwork, you know, mid-career. He kind of felt like, I don't want to say this because I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but it kind of came out that way, that he was, you know, reticent to say that, but Gruden was kind of pulling it out of him that was the case. So if he can make the switches of footwork that are more comfortable and a little bit more conventional to what an NFL coach might expect, and he's able to thrive in that fashion, then I think that there might be something more there, and I might be too down on him. But the things that I'm down on him about might go beyond whether or not he's calling the right protection and he's getting in trouble. I see things where when he sees a flash of a defender, you know, come across him, while he exhibits some good footwork to avoid pressure, there's times that he just totally accelerates his process when he feels pressure at certain moments, and when he spots it, and it can cause him to either make bad throws, not really feel the coverage in a way of where maybe mathematically he sees it. You know, it's like someone who's taking calculus, who understands the formula but doesn't understand the math. And I think that that's kind of where Hackenberg is with his game. It's like he understands maybe where he's supposed to go, what he's supposed to do. Maybe he had all these different responsibilities to his game, but when it comes to actually executing it, it seemed like he was, you know, he either rushes his process or he's not, you know, or when he's in the red zone, he's not fast enough with the process where he needs to be. I don't see touch in his game in the way that I'd like to see touch as a thrower. And then I feel like that the way he handles pressure is so inconsistent that while he does some things mechanically really well, the feel for the game seems gone. And maybe that's because of what this transition that he went through, and he's thinking too much about doing things that weren't that were big changes to him and didn't feel right to him. And if that's the case, then, yeah, maybe a guy like O'Brien can get him back, and he could work out well, and everything goes all right for him. But for me, there's too many question marks for me to put him higher than I did.
Ryan, I want you to go back to driving the ship here a little bit. We've been kind of shutting you out. But the one thing I did want to note, you mentioned those Gruden camps. A real good friend of mine is Mike Sando from our time together at ESPN. We did a million articles together. But he's always behind the scene. I mean, he travels with Gruden on Monday Night Football. He's there for all the Gruden camps. And trust me, those are some unbelievable visits. And we see about 1% of what really goes on.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
Let's move over to the running back position now. And let's look at, we'll start at kind of at the bottom of your rankings. Now, this is not a player that's near anybody's first round of the NFL draft or even first round of dynasty drafts. But this is at least a player who's been in the spotlight. He's got some name value, but you seem down on Kenyon Drake. He's your running back 28, shared time at Alabama, had a big play in the national championship game. What do you not see? What are you missing? Why are you down on Drake, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way that Drake was used most of the time, he felt to me like a gadget player. And gadget players in the NFL don't seem to take off very well. They don't seem to carry over in terms of what they can do in the league. And when I watch him, you know, certainly the size, the speed, the agility, that's all there. He shows some, flashes some moments as a pass catcher. He flashes some moments as a pass protector. But I think he's a very undisciplined runner. I just think that when I watch him play, while he can make people miss in short spaces, the way that his gait is can be a little bit too long striding and doesn't set up, he doesn't set up the moves that he can set up. He doesn't set up the blocks that he could possibly set up. I think he's immature when it comes to how to really handle the blocks that are in front of him. And he gets himself into situations where I think he could have gained a lot more yards than he does. And so when I think of, when I look at Drake overall, he just strikes me as a guy who's more athlete, who's does just enough as a pass catcher, as a pass protector, and as a runner in small areas of each position or each role, but not big enough where I would feel comfortable saying he's an every down back. And I worry that, you know, it's I think Felix Jones was a much better player, so I don't know if I can give a better compare. You know, I think I can give a better comparison if I could think of one, but it's like Darren McFadden and Felix Jones together. Jones kind of had more of the gadget end around type of things going on in that wild hog offense. And I think that Drake is a more green version of Felix Jones in that respect. It's just I don't think he really understands how to use his feet and eyes and have them in sync, along with understanding blocking schemes well enough to really be a consistent yard gainer in the NFL who's going to help move the chains, as opposed to being a space player who's kind of boom-bust for you.
And, Matt, I don't know if you agree, but it sure sounds like you do. Space players in the NFL don't quite work. You know, I mean, it's real easy to talk about it now. Like, I mean, Reggie Bush was a phenomenal college back. This guy's not close to Reggie Bush, let alone Felix Jones. I mean, at the college level. Tavon Austin was a rare, rare guy. We'll just get him in space. Well, getting him in space in the NFL is not easy, and Greg Cosell says it all the time. The hash marks are in a different location. There's not this huge wide side of the field that they have to defend where I'm just faster than you. And not to mention the linebackers all run 4-4 and 4-5. These space players in the NFL, to me, are really hard to make work. You know, oh, we'll just pick Dre Archer in the third round and get him in space. No, you won't.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And it's, you know, I wish I thought of that more when I had Tavon Austin rated higher, and it was a learning process for me, because I think it was the year I started making some changes with how I rated wide receivers and what I was looking at, because as I was going through it, I had two sets of criteria that I was working through at the time, and the new set of criteria had DeAndre Hopkins and Keenan Allen really rated as my 1-2 guys, and I ended up sticking with Tavon Austin and Cordarrelle Patterson, and after like the year and a half, 2 years, I looked back and I was like, I'm glad that I was working towards a different set of criteria that I was updating here, because yeah, you look at guys like Austin and the points that you make, Matt, about the hash marks and the speed of the defenders, even the defensive linemen. I mean, the defensive line, you know, you can't bounce things outside in the NFL and get away with it the way that you do as a running back in general. I mean, that's why even guys like C.J. Spiller, Lawrence Maroney, LeSean McCoy, Jamaal Charles, these guys all had to learn, and only half of them really learned enough to become as dominant as their potential gate really was for them to be. And so when I look at a guy like Kenyon Drake, yeah, I mean, he's a guy that's like, okay, we can use him because we have these big elephants in Alabama who are going to be able to dominate up front, and then we can use the athletes to win matchup, you know, good matchups. And Drake was a matchup player for them as a skill player.
One player that you're higher on the most, and really I'm not sure he was even on the radar maybe until the RSP came out. I've seen his name mentioned several times since then. Peyton Barber, the back from Auburn, you've got him as your running back 4. What did you see that pushed him that high for you, Matt?
Yeah, and it's probably because the backs that I tend to like are the opposite of Kenyon Drake. You know, they're guys who are skilled between the tackles. I want to see guys who understand how to set up blocks, who can get their pads down and grind out yardage, who can get yards after contact, but also show the control in their footwork. So they're guys that I think have good short area burst, even if they don't have top end speed. And Peyton Barber, to me, fits that realm of player who's powerful, that he can run through a good reach or wrap from a defensive lineman. He can push a linebacker, you know, off his spot. He's someone that also can make players miss and make multiple players miss and still maintain a line to get downhill or make that second guy miss in the hole and get into the secondary. I think he's got fabulous balance, and he's someone that showed promise to me against Alabama, being able to block players at all three levels of the field. As a pass protector, it's something he's going to have to get better at, but I liked the makings of what I saw, because I thought he showed the ability to take the fight to the defender, to get square. Maybe he had to learn how to roll his hips a little better, get better hand position at times, but all the things that he needed to learn don't put him far away from being able to get on the field from that standpoint. And, you know, a player that he reminded me of is a player who kind of got a chance to break out this year a little bit, which was Spencer Ware, another player that I liked a lot, who is, again, powerful short yardage, maybe not going to break long runs for you, but he's going to get – he can get you chunks of 10, 15, 20 yards, you know, with decent blocking and even sometimes with his cutback ability. And to me, in the NFL, that's a pretty long run to run 15, 20 yards, even though it may not be, you know, elite Adrian Peterson 50-yard gains, 80-yard gains for touchdowns.
Matt, I got a two-part running back question that I'm going to shush for a while. And for a lot of the reasons you talked about Barber, the more I watch and learn about Jonathan Williams and Jordan Howard, they're starting to really grow on me. I mean, I think they can sustain offense and be a borderline lead guy at the NFL level. And then the other question is totally different, but it goes back to Drake. I wasn't at the Senior Bowl this year, but several people told me that Drake was maybe the worst pass blocker they've ever seen in one-on-one drills. And I'm curious, you know, from a dynasty perspective, the easiest way for a running back not to get on the field is screw up pass protection, not know who to block, fumble, you know, do something along those lines. And I know you dig into all those aspects of running back play too. Who's a couple guys that might look great running the ball, but they can't pick up a blitz and they're not going to get on the field?
Yeah, and the first part question, you know, you talk about Howard and Williams, and I certainly understand why you'd like those guys, because, again, they conjure up the old school running backs of the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. who can really just pound it between the tackles, who may not be unbelievably fast, but Steven Davis wasn't unbelievably fast. That's another player who was a savvy runner who can get you the yards that you needed. And Jordan Howard kind of reminds me of that, though. His speed, what he did, you know, in workouts, it certainly causes you to think twice about whether or not, you know, I had concerns about whether the burst and the speed were there, but I'm not as doubtful now after seeing, you know, not as skeptical after seeing that. Williams is a guy that I think sometimes bounces it out a little bit too much, but his balance is so good, and he's such mm-hmm. a powerful guy. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he has that. You know, he reminded me of a guy, when I think of stylistic comps, I think of guys like Rudy Johnson and Alfred Morris, but he might end up being a little bit more dynamic than that down the line. So, you know, those guys are interesting. But when it comes to, you know, the second part of your question about guys who might not get on the field, and I certainly agree that with Kenyon Drake, what I saw at the Senior Bowl, he didn't even catch passes all that well. I mean, it was like the third down ability just wasn't there enough for me to get excited about him in that way. But when it comes to pass protection and whether guys are going to be able to get on the field, I mean, there a lot of guys are going to need a little bit, you know, going to need a little bit of work with that. But I'm trying to think of some folks that might be, you know, Trey Carson, I know there are some folks that are interested in him. I'd like to see a little bit more out of him as a pass protector. Guys that, you know, from a blocking standpoint, who I think needed a good bit of improvement. Daniel Lasko, I thought he needed to get better. Alex Collins were guys is another guy that a lot of people seem to like that I thought had to do a better job. Jarrell Presley is a guy that I think a lot of people really find interesting because of his speed out of New Mexico, and he's kind of got that Chris Johnson-like body type. He's strong, even though he's lean and kind of smaller, but he had a broken wrist too, so that might have impacted him a little bit. But even guys like Tyler Irvin and Marshawn Koprick, who are kind of lower, you know, sleeper types. Darius Jackson is another one who's got really nice ability in terms of his physical skills. But all these guys, to me, they worry me a little bit in terms of, you know, keeping their head up when they block, being able to take the fight to the defender and punch first rather than absorb the blow first and take the contact and be thrown off their game. And I think that, you know, some of those guys, they have the size to do it, but you have to see them do a better job of keeping their head up and punching or getting depth at the line of scrimmage so that they're not compressing the pocket on their own for their quarterback.
So, Matt, you mentioned your dislike of gadget players, and maybe that goes to some of the reason why you have Pharaoh Cooper as your wide receiver 47. So Cooper did a little bit of everything for South Carolina. They just had a terrible season, and he was probably asked to do more than he should have. But wide receiver 47 is by far the lowest I've seen him. He's a guy, you know, while you've been doing the RSP, I've been doing rookie mock since December. And, you know, Pharaoh Cooper is a guy who shows up in the late first round of some dynasty rookie drafts, or early to mid second round seems to be kind of the sweet spot where he comes off the board. But based on your ranking, he's a guy we shouldn't even be considering.
Yeah, and you know, I had that feeling about Ty Montgomery last year, and we'll see whether I'm wrong about that one. But, you know, certainly he got on the field and got a little bit of playing time, so, you know, that it might be the case. But when I look at Pharaoh Cooper, you know, the exposures that I had to him, I just felt like, yeah, he was more of a gadget player. I like the fact that he shows a little bit off the line of scrimmage to defeat press, but I want to see him get a little bit better. I don't think he knows how to really attack a defender yet to dictate the actions of his routes, and that's something that a lot of receivers have to learn. But he has a lot more that I think that has to improve. I just didn't see enough evidence of him setting up breaks, executing the type of breaks that you'd want to see on timing routes. I didn't think he forced defenders to turn and run against him very well. Even the way that he catches the ball, I thought that there were plays where, yeah, he could make plays in tight coverage, but I didn't see a lot of consistency with the hand position that he needed to use based on the targets that he was facing. I thought he dropped passes because of these judgment errors with his hand technique. I thought he left his feet unnecessarily to attack the football. And, to me, based on what I saw, he looked to me as a player that I think a lot of people were interested in because they see the athlete and what he does with the ball after the catch, and again, is more of a space player than a full-fledged, you know, wide receiver prospect. And if he develops, that's great. Then what I end up missing is some of those skills that I just didn't see enough on the field and didn't feel confident about. But at this stage of the game, I just couldn't give him, you know, he fit to me in the same category of guys who maybe were smaller but were clearly gadget guys like Braylon Addison of Oregon. You know, so they were fairly similar in terms of where I ranked them. They were right next to each other. And again, the gadget aspect of it was a big reason why.
Matt, I think of one wide receiver question, and I know you're a Treadwell guy. And going back to my time with the Browns, you know, that staff, Butch Davis, Pagano, Campo, Chud, they were littered. Their roots all came from the U and then the Cowboys when they were the Cowboys. I mean, the Aikman Cowboys. And to a man, everyone on that staff would tell you the most important Cowboy was Michael Irvin. Yeah, he was the most competitive human being on the planet. He made everyone around him better. No matter what he was doing the night before, he came to play and he made the team highly competitive. And I see a lot of that with Treadwell on the field. And then he said something along the lines this week like, I played the entire time in the SEC on one leg. You know, I mean, are you on board then in that regard too? That he's going to bring an attitude to whoever he joins?
Man, if I – there are two players that I really want on my team if I could have a team. And I it would be hard to turn down Ezekiel Elliott because of his talent. But if there's a player that would give him a run for his money, it would be Treadwell. And it would be because of that attitude. I mean, this is – I've joked around. This is a guy that's going to get in fights in training camp almost daily because of the way that he takes it to the defender as a blocker. And I love – I think he's a precise player as a route runner. I see a lot of precision to his game, a lot of short area quickness, and he's just a fighter with the ball, without the ball, around the ball. He's just going to endear himself to his team. He's going to be a leader. And it's because of what he does on the field. If he has the similar amount of maturity off the field as what he shows on the field, I can't imagine not wanting this guy on that type of level and picking him early. You know, people talk about the speed aspect, but Hakeem Nicks, Anquan Boldin, certainly guys who didn't run, you know, fast 40s, but I'm more inclined to look at guys who have, you know, quick change in direction with their hips, good burst, you know, players who have strength, players who understand how to use what speed they have to be able to run routes with precision, because stopping fast is more important than running fast. And certainly I've seen Laquon Treadwell stop fast as a route runner, and I've seen him use a variety of moves off the line of scrimmage. I think he's ready to play now, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if he has a fine season with a team that has at least enough around a quarterback and offensive line to feed him the football.
So Treadwell is your wide receiver one, but your wide receiver seven is another player similar to Peyton Barber. Was kind of off the radar for dynasty owners. I've seen his name pop up on Twitter and in some of these mock drafts that we've been doing since the RSP was released. Jordan Payton is your wide receiver seven. Talk about him a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, Payton to me is a guy that I've really enjoyed watching over the past couple of years. He just seemed to be the go-to guy in that offense, whether it was Brett Hundley or now Rosen. But watching him, finally getting the chance to study him on tape, I thought he was faster than people said he was. I thought that he showed skill to be able to make hard breaks and, you know, bend at the hips and make sudden stops and turns on timing routes. And he played stronger than what his size indicated. He looked bigger and stronger against defenders in the way that he was able to you know, use his body or make yards after the catch. And he was also a guy that, despite the fact that people said he didn't get a lot of separation, it seemed to me like out of the, you know, six or seven games I watched, there were multiple times in a lot of those games where he was forcing defensive pass interference plays because he was just spanking the defender playing press on him, using a nice swim move or a chop move or setting something up with his hands and feet and forcing the defender just to have to hug him from behind and pull him to the ground because he had beaten him so easily. And so then, you know, I wanted to see him at the Senior Bowl and get a chance to see him run a different set of routes or a little bit a wider array of routes and watch him in practice. I thought he was quietly one of the better route runners, you know, in the practices. And it didn't show me anything different than what I saw in the games. And he just scored out, you know, in my top 10 as a result of that.
Well, let's quickly move over to the tight end position. I just have one question for you. I think Matt has one for you as well. This position, first of all, you can share your opinion on this, obviously. It seems like it has to be one of the toughest positions to scout. The things that tight ends, they're asked to do from college to the NFL seem so different. And so many great tight ends we see at the college level never seem to pan out as they make that transition. So it's certainly a challenge, and specifically this year, I don't think there's that consensus. A lot of people like Hunter Henry, the tight end out of Arkansas. You have him as your third-ranked tight end. But talk about your number one tight end, Austin Hooper.
Yeah, I like Hooper a lot, and I think that he's a guy that in a couple of years we're going to look back and say, This is a guy who's a playmaker at the position, who's going to be, you know, probably, you know, the primary or secondary target in an offense if he gets that opportunity with the right quarterback. He's not, you know, he's not Rob Gronkowski or a top end physical prospect at this stage of his development. He's a younger guy, but I like how fluid he is around the ball. He was a player who routinely, with Kevin Hogan, was targeted in tight coverage, oftentimes between two defenders in zone, where he was asked to just go up and win the ball, and he did. I liked what he did after the catch. If you give him a throws underneath, he's quick to turn, get downfield, run through tackles, and able to make maybe that next man miss with just a nice little dip and finish strong. So as a runner after the catch, as a player who's able to win the ball in the air against tight physical coverage, he was able to do that. He could take a hit and come down with the football. And then in Stanford's blocking scheme, this wasn't Zach Ertz, you know, to me. This wasn't Zach Ertz, you know, or playing kind of a nominal inline tight end position. This is a guy that often, you know, had to make the type of blocks they would run to his side. He made the variety of blocks that I felt like showed promise for him to translate as he gets a little bit better. Sometimes, like a lot of tight ends do, he's going to overextend. Sometimes there's going to be plays where he doesn't get his hands in the greatest position or that his feet aren't in the greatest position. But I felt like more consistently than the other tight ends that I saw, he showed more in terms of being able to turn defenders that were his size or larger. He showed the ability to also drive defenders off their spot in addition to turn, or to get into space and close the gap and deliver a good punch and control his man. Those were skills that, to me, made Austin Hooper an all-around good player who may never be a superstar, but I think I would bet on him being a top 5 to 7 tight end within about 3 to 4 years. I would bet on him as being the best chance to have that upside of really what we know to be the top 3 to 5 tight ends in this class.
Yeah, sort of along what Ryan said, and scouting tight ends has to be awfully difficult right now. You know, you watch a lot more college tape than I do, but it almost goes back to the offensive line argument. Like, you used to be able to take a guard out of Michigan or Ohio State, and you knew he could run block, he could run power, he could run all the basics. Now you got to teach him all those things. Therefore, there's an offensive line shortage in the NFL. Is there any tight ends in college that are athletic enough to play in the league that you trust as a blocker?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and it's hard because the one guy that I like is Henry Krueger Kobel, and of course he's from Iowa, which is, you know, a nice which makes sense. You know, he's probably one of my favorite guys looking that way. And another guy who's interesting, who I think could be good and develop that way, is David Morgan out of Texas San Antonio. Again, it's hard. That's the hardest part of this whole thing, is that either you're not the athlete to really be the downfield threat that you're looking for on an every down basis as a receiver, or you're not the quality of blocker who's going to be able to come in and do all the different things that are required of them in an NFL system. And even a guy like Travis Kelce, who, you know, a lot of us loved, Kelce needed at least a good year to really become a solid blocker right away. And he looked good as a blocker at Cincinnati in spurts. But that's because the jump to become a blocker in the NFL is much like a jump to become a quarterback in the NFL. It's huge. And I think people underestimate that. And that's why it's so difficult to be able to scout that position.
So, Matt, you've talked about a lot of guys who are somewhat under the radar and maybe that you like more than most, but we can't let you go without asking you, who are some players, and it may be some of these that we've already talked about, but who are some players that you see yourself drafting in the second, third, or fourth round of rookie drafts that you're likely to end up with? So since we're all in a league together, go ahead and, give away some of your secrets here.
All right, well, considering that I trade away all my picks in this league anyway every year, it seems like I never do, you know.
And you got Josh Gordon back.
Yeah, and I think I've wasted mine with trading. I think Matt's going to get the better end of the deal with me on this Josh Gordon trade that I ended up taking a chance on Gordon and failing here. But, you know, guys that I really like in the later rounds or in the middle rounds, you know, certainly Kenneth Dixon is a guy that I like, you know, in the second or third round. I think he's a popular guy, but I'm certainly a fan of what he does. He's versatile. I think he's a very hard worker. He's someone that runs with the kind of I'm going to take on the world type of running back. You know, he doesn't go down on the first hit, and he's extremely versatile. So I'm a big fan of what he does. Wide receivers, certainly, you know, a guy in the, you know, Sherrone Peak is an interesting player to me who I think has room to grow and become a nice option for a team down the line. Daniel Braverman, if he gets the right fit, is an interesting player because of if he can get the right fit as a slot receiver, he has that deep speed to be able to stretch the field and even do some work on the outside. I think, you know, third or fourth round from a tight end perspective, you know, Ben Broniker's interesting. David Morgan, to me, is probably the guy that I'm most interested in seeing how he develops because he's got really good quickness. He's not the fastest guy, but he's got enough burst to get behind a linebacker in the seam, and he's excellent at adjusting the football, and he's strong. You know, strong as a runner, strong as a blocker. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets better in that regard. So these are guys that, from a value ADP standpoint in the mid-rounds, I certainly find interesting. And then from a quarterback standpoint, you know, I talked about Vernon Adams already. I thought he was an interesting guy. I think Matt touched on Jacoby Brissett. He's another one that I think that could be a nice value down the line for teams who just seems very poised, skilled at being able to handle the pass rush. You just don't want him out in space because unless you like WWF finishing moves being performed on your quarterback, this is not the guy you want in that standpoint because he's always like a half a step late trying to make a move to avoid somebody, and he just needs to learn to just get down to the ground because he's like that sap that you know, in the preliminary matches in wrestling, who's just going to get thrown around and crushed.
All right. Well, thanks again to Matt Waldman for joining us tonight. I hope you're already following Matt, both on Twitter and in general, following his work. But Matt, tell everyone where they can find your work.
Yeah, you can find me at www.mattwaldmanrsp.com. That's my blog. And if you want to check out some of the YouTube videos, you can find my YouTube channel, which is just simply called The RSP Film Room. And those two places are probably 90% of the work that you'll see, you know, that I'm doing in regards to scouting rookie talent.
Thanks so much for joining us, Matt, and we'll be back next week.
Sounds great, Ryan. It was a pleasure. Thanks again, Matt.
Good stuff, dude. Take care.